This is Nullius in Verba, a podcast about science.
What it is, and what it could be.
It's co-hosted by me, Smriti Mehta from UC Berkeley.
And me, Daniel Lagens from Eindhoven University of Technology.
In this episode, we discuss objectivity and disinterestedness in science. We talk about norms, values, interests, and objectivity in research practice, peer review, and hiring decisions. Is it possible to be completely objective? Is objectivity a feature of epistemic products or epistemic processes? And should you hire colleagues who are objectively competent but subjectively disliked? Enjoy.
The commitment of these guys to their ideas, while absolutely infuriating at times, can be a very good thing too. One should never give up an idea too soon in science, any idea, no matter how outrageous it may be, and no matter how beaten down it seems by all the best evidence at the time. I've seen too many totally disproven ideas come back to haunt us. I've learned by now that you never completely prove or disprove anything. You just make it more or less probable with the best of what means you've got at the time. It's true that these guys are a perpetual thorn in the side of the profession. And for that reason, a perpetual challenge to it too. Their value probably outweighs their disadvantages, although I've wondered many times if we might not be better off without them. Each time I reluctantly conclude, no, we need them around. They perpetually shake things up with their wild ideas, although they drive you mad with the stick-to-itiveness that they have for their ideas.
How was your really? What is the quote about? And how is it related to what we will discuss today, Daniel?
So this is an example by Mitrov from 1974, and he is describing people who are extremely biased and have their own interests, and they want to stick to their theories and not give them up, and they are annoying their colleagues by not giving in, and they are basically an example of people who are not disinterested. So they have very strong interests, and they let them guide their behavior, even though, yeah, rational people should just give up.
So you know what's interesting? I mean, we were going to talk about, yeah, so we decided the topic to be sort of objectivity and disinterestedness. So, of course, I went back to Merton and his, you know, norms, scientific norms. And then once I read more closely about disinterestedness, the way he frames it, It's a bit fuzzy, the original, some of the original text, but I think he means disinterested in sort of a you don't have vested interest sort of way. So not objective scientifically, but that you're not, you know, trying to get fame or money and those. So you're sort of not, you're disinterested in a more objective materialistic way. Which I thought was slightly different. And this is, I think, where it gets, the conversation gets really interesting, is that there are so many ways to interpret these words. And there seems to be a lot of, well, maybe not confusion, but there's a lot of competing ideas about what it even, I mean, objectivity, if you look into it, what it means. But the way you're framing it, or the way, yeah, the quote that Mitrov is framing it, I think it's quite interesting. There's a paper called Advocacy and Objectivity in Science by J. Scott Armstrong. It's actually in Management Science from 1979, where he lays out, I mean, it starts out, objectivity is a foundation of scientific work. The objective scientist is looked upon as the ideal to strive for. And here he lays out three approaches to a hypothesis. So one is advocacy, where you are trying to advocate for a certain hypothesis. And he mentions that it's more efficient because then you have one hypothesis, you're collecting your data and interpreting it just based on this one hypothesis, and you're comparing it to a null. Or you have induction, where you have no hypothesis. So you just collect data and then you rate through the process of induction. It's objective because you're not advocating for one hypothesis, but it's less efficient. And then the third idea, the third strategy is multiple hypotheses, where you're trying to pit against one another multiple hypotheses, which is both objective and efficient. So here we're talking about objectivity in the sense of, the way you approach scientific work, where you're trying to not advocate for one hypothesis, but doing it in a way that's a bit more objective.
So in Mitrov's example, that's definitely people who are advocating for one viewpoint and also their own viewpoint way too long, and it's annoying other people, you know? But it's interesting, this multiple viewpoint idea, that you can basically within one person have multiple hypotheses, and if you have them, then you're not too biased towards any of them, right? That's the idea.
Yeah, exactly. And you may have a personal bias, like you think that, one is better than the other. But in the way you're conducting your work, you're not just trying to advocate for one hypothesis, but you're trying to compare to and then see what the empirical evidence is, one supporting the other. But here's a question. I think he mentions that advocacy is more efficient in that you can do science faster if you're doing advocacy. It just becomes more efficient. And the criticism of, or I guess the support for that approach would be, hey, so I might advocate for one hypothesis, somebody else with a different bias might advocate for another, and eventually it's a marketplace of ideas where the right one will, you know, the right hypothesis will come out at the top. What would you, do you think that's true? Do you think science does work like a true marketplace of ideas where good ideas get to the top and the not so good ones are thrown away?
Yeah. Well, first, I just wanted to ask you something about this idea of having multiple hypotheses. So do you think one person can actually do this? Because then afterwards you said, okay, but different people hold different ideas. And that, I guess, makes sense. But can you come up with an example where one person would really care about these different hypotheses? It reminds me a bit when we talked about the devil's advocate, where we said, look, you have to believe in this opposite viewpoint. You can't just have it assigned to you. You can, but you might be less passionate about it. So maybe we should at least try this marketplace of ideas, and then we can take a moment and think about whether it would work in practice. But I feel, at least in terms of conviction, it might be better if different people actually really have their own hypotheses.
Competing hypotheses? I think it depends on which discipline you're talking about. I think it's much easier to have competing hypotheses in certain disciplines. I mean, if this is where I think social science is tricky to do, because people do have, you know, they've observed the world, they've observed other people, so they have certain hypotheses that are sort of ingrained because of just what data, empirical data, they have seen informally. But if you were studying, cosmology, then of course you could have, it's easier to have multiple hypotheses where you could say, okay, if the universe is flat, this is what the cosmic microwave background would look like, versus if it was curved, concave versus convex, right? It's easier to have those hypotheses versus if you are studying, you know, whether being poor makes you less happy, right? Like, I do think people probably have an idea. They either think that, having more money makes you more happy, or it doesn't. And I do think it's probably hard to come away for all. But I mean, there's no reason why. It's not necessary that you have to believe the hypothesis to test it well. As long as you can come up, as long as you can articulate an alternative that's not the null, then it should be, you should be able to study it objectively, don't you think?
Yeah. So theoretically, yes. But somehow I think, and I'm not a cosmologist, so I don't know, but it reminds me a little bit of, people have different soccer teams they like, or sports teams that they like. And to me, that's completely random. There is none better than any other. Yeah, maybe sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. But often it's just like, I grew up in the city, so I like this team, or my parents like this team. So, and I think that there's a risk, and maybe this is how it works, that theories also become like your sports team. So there's no rational reason why you would prefer one over the other. But I think there's just somewhere in this process, people pick a side and then they start to cheer for that side.
But that's not how scientists should behave, right? It's like when, if you're an umpire, imagine you're an umpire for a game and you do have one side mm-hmm. that you favor because it's your home team or whatever. In that case, I mean, it is important for a judge, for an umpire, to be objective in the impartial sense.
Sure.
Because you can't let your biases get in the way of your judgments.
This is a very, it's a good point. Is there any study about umpires and
Probably.
Whether they actually prefer soccer teams over other soccer teams and how do they do it? Are they not supposed to, you know, be the umpire for a match where they have a preference for one over the other? I mean, how do they deal with this?
Oh, good question. I mean, I'm sure somebody has studied it. This sounds too interesting not to study. And I wonder if it's possible for them to compare to like the third. Do you have the third empire? Have you heard of the third empire?
I'm not a sports person, so I don't know what this is. No, what's the third empire?
Well, I'm probably less of a sports person than you are. Well, in cricket, we have this, what they started calling the third empire. Is I think you would have two umpires on either side of the pitch. Or maybe I'm getting that. But anyway, the third umpire would just be the camera. so people can't see this. But yeah, umpires can do this where they mean, I can't make a judgment. So let's look at did the person actually cross the boundary before or after the ball hit the wicket. So it's a it's a more, objective, quote unquote, because they are unable to make a call. But I'm not, whether their personal biases affect their decisions, I can certainly see how they might.
Yeah, but in the end, we still let them supervise a match, basically, these umpires. And I think that is one working model of how we're supposed to deal with our interests as scientists. So there is work that tries to defend this model of disinterestedness.
Mm-hmm.
So it is also heavily criticized where people say, look, come on, give up on this. This is some sort of ideal state. It's not even realistic. We should just abandon this idea because it makes no sense. But there's a quite nice paper trying to defend it by Jurup and Couple from 2013.
Mm-hmm.
It's called The Norm of Disinterestedness in Science, a restorative analysis. So they're trying to sort of, restore it, give it some value again. And they say, look, it's a little bit like the umpire. You can have your own preferences, but when you do your job, you should not let those preferences influence you in any way.
Right.
Whereas I think some other people treat scientists more like the fans of a team. Like you're so biased. You are just going to be completely for this team or for the other team. But then they move the disinterestedness in science to a more collective level. And this is actually something that Merton also does.
Yeah.
So he doesn't really require individual scientists to be completely disinterested and purely objective, but he moves it up to the level of the system.
Right. So sort of the marketplace of ideas. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And that's an interesting distinction to make. And I don't know if scientists are like the sport fans, but I'm a bit sympathetic to the idea that we can be umpires. We can make objective calls, even if we have some preferences somewhere.
Yeah.
But we can do our job without being too influenced by it.
Right. And the question, and maybe this is not a totally devil's advocate position, but you have to consider, even if some scientists have theories that they favor, where is that favor coming from? And here we'll separate maybe the social sciences, because I think there are some other very thorny issues there. But if you're a biologist, you're a chemist, you're a physicist, I hope or I suspect that for them, it's more about having looked at certain evidence or look at certain past studies, and then they favor one over the other because to them that argument sort of makes sense. And maybe it's fine for them, right? Because they wouldn't have, I hope they don't come out of a hypothesis out of thin air like psychologists do. So the idea is there must be some reason for them to be a fan of that theory. And they're just trying to advocate for it and until it's proven to be incorrect or implausible. In psychology and other social sciences, I think it gets a lot more tricky because there probably are a lot of people who are just, today I took a shower and I had a thought and this is my hypothesis and now I'm going to go test it. So,
but what's the, maybe you can try to summarize what's the distinction here, the real distinction between social sciences and, okay, their hypothesis comes out of nowhere, maybe, all right, and in other fields, it comes from somewhere.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like if they're favoring a hypothesis and other maybe hard sciences, if we want to call them, it's based on some empirical data, hopefully, right? Mm-hmm. Some observations mm-hmm. or some past studies or some theory, right? Versus... Mm-hmm. In the social sciences, I think it can be a little bit more less found, like has less foundation maybe in empirical data, and maybe it's just personal experience, mm-hmm. right? Which is by definition not objective.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so some fields are by definition more objective than others. Is that the idea? And then you can't be so biased in any specific way?
Oh, I'm not saying you can't be biased. I'm just saying those biases, and maybe we have touched on this before in a podcast, but I think those biases are less personal. They may be professional mm-hmm. biases because of maybe paradigms mm-hmm. you've been part of or research lines that you follow, mm-hmm. right? So I think they're professional biases as opposed to personal individual biases.
Okay, yeah. So it's more like, for example... The sports fan is just a fan of a mm-hmm. team. It's pretty random, but they have a bit of a preference, sure. But let's say a gambler or something has a certain interest in the outcome because they want a certain team to win. So they're mm-hmm. biased for one team because then they will score more points.
But it's not that, oh, I like this team. It's that, oh, no, I think historically they have done well in these conditions. So I think that this team is more likely to win.
Yeah, or even that they get something out of it. Because if this team ends up winning, then they will be proven right, or they will make money, for example, which is another form of interest, of course.
Well, that is not objective. Now, so, yeah, right? That's the opposite of disinterestedness.
No, exactly. So, and think in the social sciences, maybe what can happen is that people want a certain outcome to be true, mm-hmm. not because they happen to be a fan of it, but because it gives them something that they value.
Right. You
know? They have an interest. They want to make a point to, yeah, maybe have political impact in a direction that they care about, or yeah, sometimes maybe even making money, because that's one of the types of interests you can get, right? Financial.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when we're talking about disinterestedness, I mean, there was a nice, another paper by Jamieson and colleagues, 2019. They mention a couple of ways in which you can have, yeah, a lack of transparency mm-hmm. and lack of openness in science. And they discuss disinterestedness. And then they also say, what are the issues here? Basically, there can be financial, mm-hmm. personal, or political interests leading to false or selective reporting. That's one of the problems they highlight with disinterestedness. So either for financial reasons or personal reasons or political interests,
right,
you introduce bias.
Yeah.
And is your point that social scientists may be more likely to introduce bias into their research for these political or personal interests compared to yeah, I don't know, the Apollo moon scientists that Mitrov was studying,
yes.
right? They're just fans of a sport team in some way. They just like their own team, but it doesn't really matter for anything. They just happen to be for this side versus the other. But in the social sciences, you have these more personal and political interests that introduce bias as well.
I think so. I think that is probably the case. That's my hypothesis.
Yeah, for certain questions in psychology, I mean, maybe not everything, but definitely I can imagine that plays a role.
Yeah, mm-hmm. psychology, mm-hmm. sociology, anything that could have like a policy or political impact, I think those are more likely to be polluted by these sort of ideological or political biases. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if we think about the way that these, this lack of objectivity can influence mm-hmm. the scientific process, where do you think that these influences occur, and where do you think they might be most problematic? Because I can see many points in the scientific process where certain interests shape what people do, and I don't think necessarily all of them are equally problematic.
And this includes all aspects of science, not just conducting your own research.
Yeah. Well, it can be your own research or, I don't know what you mean. What do you mean?
The one question would be how you conduct your own research. Mm-hmm. How does lack of objectivity come into play there versus, if I'm evaluating a job candidate?
Ah, okay.
like a candidate for a job, or if I'm evaluating, you know, whether I should not accept a paper that's not directly related to your own research. But I think there also lack of objectivity can be an issue.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, I was more thinking then about how you do your own research. Exactly. Yeah. But the other things are interesting. We might come back to them later. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the first and maybe sort of tacit way in which it might come into play is I don't think that it is incorporated into the philosophy of people who are doing research. Right? It's not, it's not something we discuss. It's not something we teach. I don't think there's ever any explicit discussion to starting students that that should be the goal. And it's usually, hey, what's your hypothesis is the question, right? What's your research question and what's your hypothesis? And I don't think from the very beginning it's something that's included as, hey, what could be a competing hypothesis? What is something that could negate your hypothesis? Like, what kind of evidence would you need to be able to disconfirm your hypothesis? At least in my experience, that's not something that's ever part of it. And then once you are, once you've come up with a hypothesis, well, then it's your hypothesis, right? It's your baby and you have to try to prove it. And I think in, and this is again where things get trickier in the social sciences compared to, say, if you were doing some other science, well, you have, your measurement tools exist. There's a certain kind of microscope. There's a telescope. You purchase it. It's something that's sort of standard. Whereas if you were doing, you know, sociology where you have, or political science or economics where you have to make indices or you have to figure out what scale to use or how to measure things, there's a lot more subjectivity in how you measure things. And that's, I think, the second place where it comes in, right? You have to pick your paradigms and you have to pick your measurement tools. And there, I think it makes it a lot easier to make subjective calls about what to use that probably, and I'm not saying this is intentional or people are aware of it, but I think it can influence how, what results you get, right? The way you ask questions can influence the results you get.
Yeah. So how to study something, right? How to study a particular topic. Yeah. And the first part is that you pick, of course, I mean, values play a role in that. Basically confirmation bias, right? You pick your own thing. Okay. So there's an overview of a couple of ways where values play a role by Elliot. It's a very nice, accessible book about values in science. And I think all of this is a bit related. I have the feeling that disinterestedness is a little bit the old-fashioned way to talk about it. And now people talk a little bit more about values in science. I think it's the same general thing.
You mean sort of instead of talking about norms, they now talk about values?
Yeah.
If you think about disinterestedness as a norm that, you know, one of the Mertonian norms, that it's now been replaced by values. Okay.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent. Yeah, so there's this difference between norms and values to a certain extent that I think actually just the norms that Merton mentioned, he has these four norms. And I think people now agree that it's sort of like a nice description of four things, but there's much more. So I think these values are much more extensive. And norms are sort of how a group of people is expected to behave. That's normative. But I think values can be, more personal, basically.
Yeah.
The way that people choose to act. But this book is quite nice, a nice overview of philosophy of science in this area. And he distinguishes a couple of points where values play a role. And I think it's nice to point this out because at some places it's impossible not to have certain values influence what we study. But it doesn't really mean that we're not disinterested at the same time. So, for example, we have to choose certain things to study to begin with. And how are you going to make the decision about what to study, right? It's impossible not to have your values guide the decisions to study. Well, I mean, it would be possible. We make a list of every possible thing that you can study, and then we randomly sample from it. But I don't think that's very desirable, right?
Sure. I don't disagree. But do you think that there are certain values which might be better for the for this purpose than others? Right, because curiosity is a value. I'm just curious about something versus studying this will make me more money or get me more grants and get more publications, that could also be a value-driven decision. Would you say that there's a hierarchy of maybe some are better than others, even though we can't be objective? The values that you use to guide that decision, there might be some better than others.
So I definitely think this is a very important thing that determines what we study, and it's not objective at all. And pure curiosity would be objective, but curiosity doesn't emerge for everything in the same sense. I mean, then you would have to have a system where people are randomly curious about stuff. It's randomly distributed across all possible things.
Well,
you think that's it? Yeah. No, I don't think this is the case. I mean, practically speaking, people enter the field because they find certain problems interesting. I think that's how it works.
Yeah. Well, but they have to be viable, right? If you're interested in knitting needles, I don't know, you can't be a scientist out of curiosity for, you know, how knitting works. Or maybe you can, I don't know. But you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, but if things were perfectly randomly distributed, there are a couple of people who study knitting. It actually sounds quite interesting, but maybe. Okay, anyway.
My point. You know, Daniel, that I do think people are probably curious randomly about stuff, but in terms of being a paid researcher, society also poses some constraints on what is viable for you to study as a researcher who's getting public funds. Right?
Yes. Yeah, and we have to come back to this topic of, look, what gets you money and what gets you... Okay, but we'll park it for a second. So another thing where values play a role is, as you mentioned, deciding how to study a particular topic.
Yeah.
You know? All right, and then there's determining the aims of scientific inquiry in certain contexts. Determining the aims, so what are we trying to achieve? Do we want to have practical interventions or theoretical knowledge? Or what are we aiming for? Then there's something about how to respond to uncertainty. So your values can determine how much uncertainty you think is okay.
Hmm.
And when you want to, for example, warn the general public about a research finding, is this after the first study has come out? Mm-hmm. Or do you want to be very careful? That's another point of a value.
Interesting.
And then the last is how to communicate results, where there's also some values that play a role. Now, the important thing that is missing from this list is basically how you make claims, how you make scientific claims.
I was just going to say how you interpret, I would have put it as how you interpret the evidence.
Yes.
Yeah,
and
right.
The point, I think, that sort of is the maybe consensus point in this philosophy and science on values is all of these other things are almost impossible to prevent. And from this paper that I mentioned before by Jurup and Koppel, they actually have a nice quote here. They say, the disinterested scientist is not someone who is indifferent to research interests or scientific significance. And they say even financial or social rewards, which we really have to discuss, or social consequences are like, she is simply someone who does not let interest, ubiquitous as they are in science, interfere with her ability to produce reliable claims about the world. So this is the key thing. You can have all sorts of values mess up all sorts of decisions and things and how you talk about it, but the interpretation of the data, the claims have to remain reliable. And there, if you are interested, you know, you have your values that influence science, then you introduce bias into the claims.
Yeah.
And that I kind of like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the features that objectivity should have, one was accurate representation of the world. The other was it should be epistemically valuable. Or like we have to ensure that epistemic processes are objective because we trust objective processes more. Right? And this is what we're talking about, right? Even though you have these biases, if the process is objective, then we can trust the result a bit more. Right? Whatever's the claims you're making as a result of that.
Yeah.
You don't agree?
Well, I think a lot of people don't agree with this because philosophers of science. No, I think a lot of philosophers of science say, but this process, there is no objective process. The scientific method is never objective.
Okay, here, that's a bunch of. Yeah.
That's a bunch of what? Complete the sentence, please. Just
hogwash.
For my enjoyment.
Hogwash.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
This is a child friendly podcast.
So as often, I agree with you, but this is the thing that many philosophers of science find so attractive about this topic, because they think this part is not objective. It's not possible. Now, this paper of a restorative analysis mm-hmm. is also on your side. It says, yes, we can have a process where scientists are actually just making objective claims and using methods to remain unbiased about things. So I agree with you that it's possible, but I don't think everybody agrees.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who will talk about, well, true objectivity or complete objectivity is not possible, so we can't. Or this also comes up, maybe we also want to talk about, although I don't know how much of an issue it is in the Netherlands, just institutional neutrality. They're like, oh, you can never be neutral. It's just not possible. I'm mm-hmm. like, yeah, but it's like you're saying that world peace is not possible. It's like, okay, that very well may be the case, but mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean you shouldn't aim for it, right? The point is not to say that it's completely possible perfectly. The idea is that that's something we strive for, and we may mm-hmm. fail, mm-hmm. and it may not be possible completely, but it's certainly sometimes possible, and it's certainly something we should aim for. That's the idea.
Yeah. And then there's this difference we discussed before, that maybe you don't even need to aim for it individually, but you need to aim for it as a collective of scientists.
Right.
So that together our process, we have checks and we criticize each other and together we get to this. But I also kind of feel somewhat sympathetic, and maybe we should reflect on whether we're able to do this ourselves, but I feel kind of sympathetic to the idea, like this empire idea, that you can just supervise a match and look at both sides and be relatively fair in your evaluation. I mean, isn't that, for example, something that we have to do when we review?
Mm-hmm.
That you're relatively unbiased about things and you just evaluate. So I have the feeling when you're a reviewer, you look at claims people make, whether they follow logically, whether everything is coherent, and whether you agree with it or not doesn't really matter. It shouldn't really matter. That's not your role. It's not like, okay, do I agree with your, that this is worth studying even? I mean, you can make a comment about it, or, but you should just say, is this coherent? Is there no bias in the conclusions you draw? Fine. Go ahead. This is fine. And you can do this, even if you disagree with the main point, I think.
I definitely think you can do this. Is this what people do?
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about sort of, you know, what's normative. Versus, I mean, yeah. I think it is certainly possible, but and again, this is where I think it comes down to it's, and you're seeing it more and more. I mean, sometimes when you read open reviews mm-hmm. and stuff, you can tell that people are coming, or even papers where they're not even trying to be unbiased.
Yeah.
They're not even trying not to. Yeah. And I think this is where we're failing as an institution, if we're not instilling this as a value to begin with, right?
Yeah.
Like, hey, even if you have, right, it's fine to have certain, you know, predilections of like, I like this theory versus the other, or I like this method versus the other, but you should really try to be as objective as you possibly can when you're evaluating things or when you're,
And also that we indeed try to at least not give up on it from the outset.
Right.
Not like, oh, come on, it's possible, impossible, but that we say, no, this is the goal. You should practice. You should train. We'll guide you and mm-hmm. we'll help you to achieve this. And mm-hmm. then you can get pretty far.
Yeah.
And I had a personal experience not too long ago where I was asked to review basically a discussion between two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And in this discussion, I was definitely, in terms of personal connection, much more closely attached to one side,
mm-hmm.
which contained former collaborators, friends, then the other side, which contained people that I've never collaborated with and even had quite negative interactions with on social media.
Hmm.
And here I tried, and whether people are happy with what I've done is a different thing, but what I really tried to do is really evaluate the claims. And what I liked in this process myself, first of all, I pointed this out in the beginning of my review. I said, okay, so I just have to declare that one side consists of people that I've worked with and that I have positive experiences with, and the other side actually contains individuals that I have quite negative experiences
with. Interesting. You put out a positionality statement. Good for you, Daniel.
I declared some conflicts of interest, yes. Whether that's a positionality statement is a question, but okay, I declared some conflict of interest. But what I liked about when I went through all of the arguments is that sometimes I agreed with one side, mm-hmm. sometimes I agreed with the other side, and sometimes I disagreed with both sides.
Mm, interesting.
So I have the feeling that this, what I wrote, was I really tried to be objective here. Because I think it's very important that these conflicts that sometimes, or these arguments, these discussions, that they emerge, it's important, and that we are completely, well, as objective as possible in resolving them. We don't want this to become a sort of political battle.
Yeah.
You want to stick to the facts and look at the arguments and evaluate them. Now, whether I managed or not, I don't know, but I really tried.
And it's really the trying that counts, right? I think. That as long as that's your aim, that's good. And I like what you said about sticking to the facts, right? I do think that it is much easier to be objective when you can stay close to the facts.
Yeah. When you evaluate the arguments.
Exactly. Or, right, if you can state, okay, this is what they're arguing. This is where I disagree, but this is why, right? They said X. This is why it doesn't make sense. Or this is, they said Y, and they didn't provide any evidence for this. Instead of, I think, opinions are now considered just as valid as facts. And I don't think that's true, right? You can have opinions about facts, but you should first state the facts and then say why or why not they may be valid or follow from the argument. And I think when you can stay closer to the facts, it's easier to be objective.
And I think we should try to do this. And I had another experience recently with a review where somebody said something, criticized as a reviewer, criticized something I wrote. And they said, look, you're making this claim here, but this is just your opinion. And I happen to disagree with this. So you should say here that this is just your opinion.
Mm.
And then I replied, no, in the reply to reviews, I said, this is not my opinion. This is an argument derived from a certain philosophical perspective. And I think that matters because it means that my argument is coherent from a certain viewpoint. It's not just a random opinion that you can disagree with. You can disagree with the philosophy of science. That's perfectly fine. But you shouldn't say that this is just an opinion. We have a fact, or we have a disagreement about a philosophy, right? And we can objectively disagree about this philosophy. We're not disagreeing about opinions. We're not fighting over our opinions. We're disagreeing about logical arguments that we derived from some sort of starting point, right? So I feel as long as you can do that between reviewers and authors and stuff, this process can be very valuable. And people can point out, like, hey, why are you saying this? Where's this argument coming from?
Right.
Those are very good questions to ask as a critical reviewer. This reasoning goes too quickly. I don't understand where this point is coming from. Those are perfectly valid points to say as a reviewer, but not, I think this is a silly thing to do or to think or to believe or whatever. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Which you might also feel and think, but that's not your role as a reviewer to criticize this.
Yeah. What about hiring decisions or who to bring on, right? Like how you evaluate any applications, whether it's for students or for positions, for grants. Well, but grants might be more closer to peer review, which we've already kind of talked about, right? You want to stick close to what the merits of the... But I think even objectivity when you're evaluating people can be even harder.
Yeah. I think this is a very interesting question. I didn't think about it a lot, but... No, but I recently had a conversation about values and grants. And I think that one argument people have for random allocation of funding... Maybe especially after a certain...
Yeah, threshold. Okay, yeah. You meet a certain threshold. After that, it's a lottery.
Exactly. This is an idea that people have put forward. And the reason is because otherwise our values just, you know, I mean, our values will dominate. And what do they matter? They shouldn't matter. So if quality is high enough, randomly fund. And somewhere there, I feel kind of, well, okay, I know. I think it's worth trying. And actually, we had a sort of funding scheme from... a center, it's called the Center for Unusual Collaborations. It's a fun thing between some Dutch universities are trying to promote interdisciplinary research.
Nice.
And when we were on this board, we were distributing research money, and we actually introduced this sort of random allocation of money. Okay, so I'm sympathetic to that, but I wouldn't generalize that to hiring. I mean, imagine that you say all of these people are equally capable.
Mm-hmm.
Now we just randomly draw one out of the hat, and that's the person we hire. Because there we definitely choose fit with the department, which is just how much do I like working with somebody like this. No, I mean, honestly, that's what it is, like fit. Don't you think so? Yeah, maybe not completely. I mean, it can be we need somebody to teach this thing, and that's a good fit. We don't have a person like you yet. No, but I think it's also, do I want to work with you?
You know, that's so interesting. I recently had a conversation with some faculty about exactly this. And I pointed out, I was like, imagine we were trying to staff a team of mm-hmm. people who were going to land, you know, the next mm-hmm. rocket on the moon. Like, would it matter if there were people who you didn't get along with, if they were really, really good at their job?
Mm-hmm.
It really yeah. wouldn't matter. What you would want is the most competent people, regardless of their personal qualities. And they're like, well, we're not doing rocket science. I'm like, well, yeah, duh.
I do agree with you on the level of the entire community involved in a certain project.
Yeah.
But whether they should actually work together in the same place, I'm not sure. And I have to think about this story where there were two researchers on Antarctics. So they were really on this remote, you yeah. know, center somewhere on Antarctics. And one stabbed the other because they got into such an argument. One was so annoying. Apparently he was, you know, the other one was reading books, and then the other person was just talking about the ending of the book, like really, you know, oh. ruining the experience. And then one guy stabbed the other. So anyway, oh, I think, Jesus. Yes, over the entire research community, yeah, personality and all that stuff doesn't matter. Within a small team, yeah, it pretty much matters. We don't want colleagues stabbing each other. So I think it's fine if you get along to a certain extent. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that is super interesting.
Yeah, I already disagree with myself, Shmiti. I already disagree. Like, rationally, I want to disagree with myself, but practically, I think this is just how it is. But I also think, so where are these people who are so annoying? They should also be in science, I agree, but where should they work? And then I'm like, well, maybe not in my department.
Yeah, I'm trying to sort of figure out why I don't like the idea. Because here's the thing, like, I sort of, in some ways, I kind of get that you want to work with people that you get along with, and everything should be hunky dory. We should be able to, you know, hold hands and sing by the fire together.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like if you were, and maybe this is just naive of me to think, right? Like, why is it a problem to work with somebody you dislike? Right? It's only a problem if you let your subjective assessment of them as a person get in the way of the work, or it will,
mm-hmm.
you know, or you'll just be in a bad mood anyway, right? Like, but it shouldn't be such a big problem to be civil to people you dislike, right? Like, it mm-hmm. doesn't mean you have mm-hmm. to work directly mm-hmm. with them. I mean, nobody in a department is obligated to work with people who are next door, but as long as they're in yeah. the same department, you should be able to just yeah. you know, engage with them in, you know, polite conversation. And
I agree. No, that's true. And I also think, I mean, they're not really people that, it's rare that there's somebody who is disliked by everyone. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but then there's probably some sort
you've
of
not,
real
you,
problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, but I do think this is, and this is maybe what, because I've heard people, I mean, at my university, a lot of people who do get a lot of what I would think of as just incivility from their colleagues because they,
mm-hmm.
you know, express their mm-hmm. views, and they're, you know, opinionated people. And it makes me so mm-hmm. sad, because I'm like, it's one thing to dislike or disagree with somebody. Like, you can't like everybody. It's totally a normal human mm-hmm. thing to dislike somebody, mm-hmm. to disagree with somebody, and not want to spend Christmas with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's another to, but it's another thing to sort of openly be rude or standoffish or not even say good morning and not respond to mm-hmm. niceties. I think that's just, and this is where I yeah. think you have a certain sense in which you people are letting their personal and ideological biases get in the way of, you know, being yeah. a, you know, sort of yeah. objective, decent human beings. I think, you know, you can, yeah. there's no reason for you to be. Yeah, yeah, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe for a team to work well, you do need.
No, I think you're right. So basically what it sounds like you're saying is that this norm of disinterestedness should also play a role in personal interactions. On
I think so.
You should also just be like, It needs to. It needs to, because these we need, if we agree that everybody has their own sort of bias and on the collective level,
right,
we resolve these differences, then we need all these people in science. And that means they need to work also at your department. That's just
that is exactly, because here's the thing.
I agree. Okay. The next person I'm going to hire, I'm just going to be like, okay, you're so annoying. Like, who's the most annoying person? Yes, I'll hire you. It's your turn. It's the turn to hire.
But no, but I think there's value in that, right? Because you need people who disagree with you for so that they will criticize you. They will force you to lay out your arguments better and make your case a lot better. But who are you more likely to like as a person? Somebody who disagrees with you or agrees with you? Right. It's just human nature to just like people more when they agree with you. Right. So insofar as somebody disliking is somebody, I really just don't agree with them. I don't.
Yeah. I just have this. Yeah. I just have this problem that, you know, I'm, of course, always right. So if people disagree with me, it is also completely confounded with the fact that they are wrong about things. It's not that I don't like that they disagree with me, but they're also intellectually wrong. But let's ignore that point.
If we listen back to all the times we've disagreed on this podcast, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. I get it. Okay.
I just changed your mind about something. So how about that?
No, it's true. Yeah. It's true. I mean, it's a good point. And my subjective feeling that I should hire people that I like is definitely not the way to have a healthy scientific system.
I mean, and it's even from a perspective of, hey, we want to hire people who are more diverse, more dissimilar. Yeah. We are more likely to like people who are more like us. So if you want a more diverse team, you should try to hire people who maybe just don't, right off the bat, you're like, oh, I don't know about this person, right? Assuming they're competent and assuming they're not a total asshole, right? I'm not saying hire just the worst people.
Yeah. No, they also have to have some set of skills.
And,
but okay, I'm never going to recommend that we hire you now. So just because you said this. So good. I wanted to bring up another issue. So you mentioned that I declared that I liked certain people more than other people, which is true in my review. And you said that this is a positionality statement, right? I think it's sort of like a statement of interest.
Right.
And I want to bring up something that I found very interesting, how to deal with the fact that we have certain interests, something that I like a lot. And this is a website by Stefan Sen, who's a statistician. And he has a declaration of interest page. So he is explicitly acknowledging the fact that he is not a completely objective researcher. He has certain interests. And what he's doing is declaring them explicitly.
Why? I mean, that's such a... Isn't that true for everybody?
So we might get to this, but I'll read out some of his interests.
Yeah.
Because indeed, maybe it's true for everybody. But if you read the things he says, I'm curious what you think about the things he says. All right. So the reason why he writes about this is because he thinks that, there are just biases. He wants you to know about these. So he has interest as a scientist. There are a couple of categories, but this is the first. Interest as a scientist. And he writes, I am a scientist and also worked as an academic for a total of more than 25 years, and my career is furthered by publishing. Controversial topics often attract greater publicity, and this should always be borne in mind. Before my retirement in 2018, my performance contract required that I publish in high-impact journals. Do you think this is a declaration of interest?
No.
You don't think so? I like this statement of controversial topics often attract greater publicity. Don't you think this is an interest that scientists have?
Well, but I don't see how... he's not even explicitly saying that he did research on controversial topics just so they would get attention. Now, if he said that, I would say that's honest, right? And maybe I can respect that a bit more, but you're just stating, hey, controversial ideas get more traction. It's like, okay, that's just a fact. You don't need to tell me this. I know this already.
Yeah, but I think he writes this because it means if you see a paper by him and it's about something controversial, or he makes a claim about something that's controversial, you are basically allowed to think, yeah, this is of course a little bit in his interest to write a paper making this controversial statement, because it will draw a lot of attention, which is good for his career.
But wouldn't I think that anyway? It's weird to... Yeah, I don't see what it adds.
Well, I think it adds some transparency about the fact that this is just sometimes true.
Here's the thing. Maybe I'm studying something that wasn't controversial, but is suddenly now controversial. I could be making those claims regardless, because I've been studying this for this whole time, but now it's controversial. So now is it right? I don't see how having this statement makes a difference anyway, because even if somebody said, hey, I'm actually not making this statement because it's controversial, this is just what I study, it's not like anybody would believe it, right? It's like, it doesn't change. That's what I mean. Like, having the statement doesn't change my opinion of what I'm reading either way.
Yeah, I get it. It would be even more honest if in a specific paper, mm-hmm. where he's writing something just to be controversial, he would say,
I'm just
this
doing
specific
this
paper. I'm just bullshitting, basically. I'm just riling some people up.
I would respect that a lot more. Yeah.
Okay. So it would be more honest if you just explicitly write it in a paper that mm-hmm. you're just riling people up. I agree. So this is something that my colleague Vlasta Sikimic sent me yesterday. It's a paper by Paul Feyerabend. Mm. And this is just this honesty that you're looking for. And
yeah.
In this paper, which we'll link to, he writes, about a year ago, I was short of funds. So I accepted an invitation to contribute to a book dealing with the relation between science and religion. To make the book sell, I thought I should make my contribution a provocative one. And the most provocative statement one can make about the relation between science and religion is that science is a religion. So there you go. He's just honestly about this, like, look, hey, I needed to make some money. I made this provocative statement, so there you go. Yeah?
A lot more respectable.
Now, okay, so it would be nice if they attach it to the paper, but I still think there might be something to at least acknowledging or reminding people, maybe reminding yourself, I don't know, that, yes, controversial topics attract more publicity, so sometimes people just dive into a topic, make a provocative statement, at least it shows some self-awareness, okay.
But where does it end would be my question, right? Any publication you make is advancing your career. Any talk you give is advancing your visibility. Like anything you do
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. And to be fair, sometimes people consider some of the points that I make. For example, you know, I will defend the use of p-values. Mm-hmm. And I think dichotomous claims in science actually play an important role. But sometimes people think that I might be bullshitting, that I'm defending a topic here just because it's the counterpoint. I just actually really happen to believe in it. So how do you distinguish whether I'm just riling people up or I actually really believe in it?
Oh, you really think if you said that, the people who don't want to believe you will actually believe you after you made that statement? I don't think so.
That's a good point. You might be right that it doesn't do anything. Nevertheless,
yeah.
I'll give some other interests that are declared.
Okay.
Statement of nationality. I was born Swiss and tend to have a prejudice in favor of Switzerland, Swiss institutions, and even Swiss companies. Do you think this is fair to point out as a declaration of interest? I think this can be actionable. If I would invite this person as a reviewer and they say explicitly, like, hey, I'm pro-Swiss and people and stuff, then I'm like, okay, well, maybe you shouldn't review papers by a fellow countryman then or something. No.
I don't understand the point. Unless it was something that was going to actually affect your work, I don't know why I need to know this. It's like, what if they're like, hey, these are my biases for, like, which ice cream I like to eat. Not that relevant. For, you know, you like chocolate,
ice cream,
I like
nuts.
Strawberry. Like, who cares? Like, is it going to affect your work? Now, I don't think
ice cream
so.
Nut. But what if this person publishes a paper that says, hey, in this debate about whether this Swiss company, this drug development company, did a good job or not did a good job, my evaluation is they did
good
job.
Implicitly, what it's saying to me is that they're saying that, hey, this might affect the objectivity of the process I'm engaging in as a scientist. That's what they're saying,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm not saying that if you don't say it, you're not mm-hmm. doing that. Yeah, people might still be doing mm-hmm. it. They're just being transparent about it. But it's almost mm-hmm. like you're being transparent about it is like a license. Oh, yeah, like, oh, you, this is how you should evaluate it. It's like, well, you should at least have tried not to let it affect your work. But if you're saying, oh, my nationality is something you need to know that I'm biased in favor of Swedish people, to me, that sounds mm-hmm. like, hey, this affects yeah. my work. Like, I let this affect my work.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand. I think I agree. I'm not sure. So I agree that these statements are sort of, I don't want to say they're performative, but they have
I will. Yeah, they seem a little performative.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah. I'll give you one more statement of interest as an author. I'm the author of Crossover Trials in Clinical Research, Statistical Issues in Drug Development, and Dicing with Death. I obtain royalties for sales on these books. Now, I mean, this means that if you would recommend these books, for example, right? If you keep mm-hmm. recommending your books, then you maybe think, hey, why are you recommending these books? I mean, you might want to sell them or something, you mm-hmm. know, make money of it. It's not really a good recommendation that you're pointing to your own book. Now, here I had a thought myself, because mm-hmm. I also often refer to my own textbook, but
it's free.
I have intentionally made it free mm-hmm. to prevent having some sort of conflict of interest mm-hmm. or something. It's free. I just think it's useful for people to learn. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I guess I kind of agree with you that it is better to show how you deal with the conflict of interest
right.
than stating it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it would have been more impressive if he said, look, I am biased towards Swiss people. Therefore, I will always reject
right.
reviewing yeah. papers by fellow countrymen or mm-hmm. something. I mean, that would also be a bit extreme,
yeah.
but you know, you get the idea that you deal with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I like it. Yeah, yeah, that's good. Maybe because I was thinking, should I write something like this? Because on the one hand, I feel it's nice and transparent. But on the other hand, I thought, yeah, what do you get from it? But maybe it's nicer to write, there are certain interests that I have, and this is how I actively try to deal with them. For mm-hmm. example, instead of selling you a book, I've made it available for free. Instead of, you know, I'm negative towards these people, so I will always refuse to review their work to prevent biasing it, for example, you mm-hmm. know? Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I like it. I mean, it's something to think about, I think. All right. So we're not a fan of declarations stating them, but we are a fan of showing how you'll deal with them.
Yeah. And for the, I mean, I'm not in favor of most of these personal, I find them slightly self-indulgent, a lot of these statements of like, mm-hmm. this is who I am as a researcher, these are my whatever. Because like, we talked about, it's a norm, right? That we at least try to aim for.
Yeah.
Universalism, yeah. and you should evaluate yeah. work on its merit and not based on who you are and what your individual biases might be, right? If you're doing good work, that's how it should be evaluated. And this is where the objectivity comes into play, right? If I can trust your process, then even if mm-hmm. I don't trust mm-hmm. your interpretation, which may be more subjective, at least I know, okay, your evidence has come out, right? The evidence from your work, I can look at it myself yeah. and then judge it for how good it is and how well yeah. your methods are. How well your statistics yeah. are, and yeah, then we can go from there, right? Yeah. Otherwise, it's, yeah.
Yeah. No, it is very interesting. So, because I was thinking, so maybe let's say this review where, you know, there's one side that I am closer to and one side that I'm less close to. And then I could either have said like, okay, I don't review papers of people that I, you know, I have negative experiences online with, but then, you know, I would stop reviewing altogether. No, just a joke. That's just a joke. But I could say, which is more realistic, like I have shown repeatedly in the past that I'm willing to criticize my
both
friends,
sides, yeah.
which mm-hmm. I have done, you know, in publication. I have criticized people that I'm mm-hmm. close with if I disagree with them. So, yeah, maybe that's nice that you can say, look, I've shown in the past that even if you're my close friend, I will criticize you if I think you deserve to be criticized.
Yeah.
So that's the way that I hope to be objective.
Yeah, I can be objective mm-hmm. in my evaluation of any claim and any argument, right? And that's a goal. Mm-hmm. Again, mm-hmm. I'm not saying we achieve it all the time, but it's certainly a goal,
mm-hmm.
a noble goal.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I agree that what you mentioned before, that this is an important thing to strive for, to educate people about, and not just give up on it altogether. And that's a valid point, I think. That's an important one.
And there's so many things that fall in this category, right? Even truth. People are like, oh, we can never get to the truth. It's like, maybe, but but if we give up that, then what else is there? Right. It's an ideal.
We should aspire.
Yeah.
We should aspire to certain things. And I think, I'm also feeling comfortable saying we should aspire to objectivity, even if it's not completely achievable in some way. But we should at least aspire to it and then let the remainder of the bias that's remaining, let that be solved at the higher level through criticism between peers.
Yeah.
In this paper on a restorative look at disinterestedness, they discuss a lot of points where you're like, oh man, these are just weak criticisms. These are, you know, I mean, they nicely push back to some of this criticism on disinterestedness where they say, yeah, it's not possible and stuff. And you're just like, yeah, this is just such weak points.
So Daniel, after all this conversation about objectivity, out of 5 stars, how objectively, how many stars would you give our podcast?
Our podcast is my favorite podcast ever. A completely objective evaluation. This is just,
Yeah. I give us 3.5 stars.
3.5 stars. Out of 5.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Nullius in Verba. Our theme song is Newton's Cradle by Grand Brothers. If you have any thoughts, feedback, or comments you'd like to share, you can reach us over email at nulliusinverbapod@gmail.com or our social media accounts at Mastodon or Twitter.
In this episode, we discussed whether we should aspire to disinterestedness and objectivity as scientists and the role values play in science. Over the next 3 episodes, we will discuss the first 8 lectures of Paul Meehl's Philosophical Psychology course, which touch upon many of the topics we discuss in this podcast. We hope you will join us.